I'm like, what is this? What am I watching? I'm watching people that I know and respect read this manifesto from Sinclair. And I know I struck a nerve, Bobby, because that night I tweeted out something about Sinclair and what was going on. And Cheryl Atkinson, by the way, who has a big, big role at Sinclair. She does a community affairs show on Sinclair called Full Measure, and it's distributed to all their affiliates, and they have to run it. And she came at me on Twitter, so I knew I had made a point. She said to me, there is absolutely no difference between what those anchors and reporters are doing than any other station promo. And I totally disagree, Bobby. We never got a must read in my entire time, ever, in TV news. And I work for Fox. I work for small companies, and I work for a big company like Fox. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I also worked for Clear Channel at the time, which was pretty big too. So we never, ever had anything like this thrust upon us. And we never, ever had our executives at the companies we work for saying, you have to run these stories. These have to run. It doesn't work that way. There's a clear separation between company and the news department.
Yeah.
It's that simple.
I read it from a reputable green team site. This is from the CelticsBlog.com, right, Murray?
Correct.
Okay. Bobby Manning wrote this the other day, and it was just a survey of the players that came out of the third lottery position. Not the third pick, but the teams that started with the third lottery position and what happened. He said,
this is Cousin Anthony. Welcome to the Bobcast.
I'm going to bomb this shit.
So that's where I got it from, Dave, just by the way.
My friend Anthony Vasquez is the kind of guy you can have a conversation with anything about. I give him a lot of credit. He's a supportive guy. He'll put down what he's doing to come through the house. Probably spends a little bit too much time at our place, but it's what a good friend's all about. I would describe Vasquez as a good friend. That came into question last week. Now, Monday, I'm running the Boston Marathon. I did a little bit of podcast with Sam Fortier about that back in January. You can get that on the Bobcast iTunes stream. This is the Bobcast, a weekly tour of sports and pop culture. And I'm Bobby Manning. So, I found myself in Ernie Davis Dining Hall, which is the worst dining hall you can go to. It's the same stuff as all the other dining halls, as I always say, but it is so overrun by masses of people throughout the afternoon that the employees, the infrastructure, everything just gets burnt to a crisp. The one thing I'll give Syracuse Dining Halls credit for, even though I'm a staunch critic of them. I don't have a meal plan this year. I cook at home. They got good cookies, and I eat relatively healthy. I eat a lot, but usually it's good stuff. I'm on my game extra this week because I don't want to have any nonsense in my body going into 26 miles, especially when my knee's already killing me, and I've only reached 17 miles in training. So I'm on my game diet-wise. Now, me and Vasquez are leaving the dining hall. Bless me with a meal swipe. And we pass my biggest weakness in diet. Cookies. Insomnia cookies kills me. Everybody knows that. Because if I walk by, I'm going in and getting one of those chocolate chip cookies. Now, chocolate chip cookies are the only good cookie that exists. And so I am always going to fall for one. Now, this time I didn't. As we walked out of Ernie, me and Vasquez, 500 cookies laid out along the heated oven where you grab them from, right alongside it. There were more cookies than you've ever seen here. And I resisted. So, I go to the sushi counter. never was a big sushi guy before I got to college, but the dining hall changed that. They got pretty solid sushi. So number one dining hall thing here is cookies. Number two I'll give them is their pasta bar. And number three is their sushi. Now, there's these little rolls that they got. I think it's from Wegmans. Everybody loves Wegmans. And I can see why when I eat their sushi. Get these little crab ones with avocado and some white substance popping in my mouth. I'd eat like 10 of those. Until Vasquez, on the bus heading back to South Campus, hit me with the news that there's cream cheese in the sushi. Now, that blew my world up because I eat cream cheese on my bagels. Try not to, like I said. Very diet conscious man right here. But the texture, the thought of cream cheese being in this sushi, cleverly named the Philly roll, which I thought meant it was Philly born, not Philadelphia cream cheese, which I guess is the meaning behind it. Anyway, Vasquez ruined the Philly roll forever for me, because even though I love crab, I love that little rice outer bound they have around it. Avocado is one of my favorite foods. You're not mixing cream cheese with that. So it's all over. Let's call Vasquez. Hey.
Hello, Bobby. How you doing?
What's up?
Nothing. Everything's fantastic. As you know, we're living a good life. I just came out of a self-defense course, so I guess I'm an SU boxer now. On my way to South.
So you're officially a boxer?
Yeah, I guess I'm officially a boxer now. wasn't my intention, but...
Well,
it is what it is.
You're a man of many skills, and I need you to tell the listeners what your diet advice for them is, because you already ruined ruined the Philly roll for them, as I told them, and I need you to give them the other piece of advice you gave me on the bus.
Oh, yes, the wonderful choo-choo spit diet. I do recall that exactly. Yes, the choo-choo spit diet. I do that whenever I have sugar urges. What I tend to do is, you know, take a piece of whatever sweet that may be, because, you know, we all want sweet. You take two or three bites to get the sugar taste, and then you spit it all out.
Now you
get all the fun and none of the calories.
You put this on display one night in our apartment, if I remember correctly, right?
Did I? I mean, I don't recall that night. Actually, no, I do remember that night. Yes, the fun tool. I do recall that, yes, apparently.
Yeah, Vasquez decided one night to do the choo-choo spit diet with the pretzels on our floor, and that was just his best night of all the nights he spent over our apartment. We enjoyed that a lot.
And you remember that, actually, yes. Apparently I did the same thing with the water, too, right?
Yeah, even though water is zero calories, you decided to do it with the water anyway.
I know, but I mean, my body looks pretty dangerous. Over time, it's not a bad diet. I don't advocate it at all, but I've turned out well for it.
Thanks, Vasquez.
I do recall that.
Now, the other big debate I had over the week was with my man Leo. Leo was trying to tell me that McDonald's has the quintessential chicken sandwich. So he's going to answer for that right now.
Bobby.
Leo. All
right.
You're about to be interrogated by me.
Where's this happening?
Over the phone right now. So.
All right, let's hear it.
You're trying to tell me there's a difference between fast food and fast casual. Can you define that?
Bobby, yeah, okay, ready? Here's fast food. You go through the drive-thru, and you get your food, and you eat in the car. Fast casual, thank you. A little more pricey, but you get your food, and you sit down and eat it in the restaurant. Matt's laughing at me right now, but...
So price is a key element. You never told me that. What's the price line on...
Price is absolutely a key element, but it's not like... I mean, there's a threshold. So, like, if you're paying more than, like, I don't know, like, like $12-ish. It's like too expensive. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Fast casual is between five and like 12, I would say. And you also like would sit down and eat it in the restaurant.
So you were telling me that McDonald's is the king of fast food when it comes to chicken, right? Now, I vehemently disagree with you on that because I'm a big Wendy's chicken guy. But they're in a different class, you say, from Chick-fil-A, which I can't come to grips with that because, in my opinion, we're going to have to check the back of Chick-fil-A for this, but I think they're preparing stuff the same way they do at McDonald's and Wendy's. But you think they're breading chicken in the back of Chick-fil-A?
I don't think they're breading it. I think they're cooking it like made to order. Like, I think that like if you walk in there and you ask for like food, like they're gonna cook it for you as opposed to just like already have it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm not on board with that, but we're gonna test that one day. What's you tie together Chipotle and Chick-fil-A, which I can't come to terms with either.
Here's the way I see it. So if you like picture a line, ready? On the far left side of this line is McDonald's. On the far right is Chipotle, and smack dab in the middle is Chick-fil-A.
So there's a spectrum.
Oh, there's a spectrum for sure. Yeah. Chick-fil-A is like on the lower end of fast casual.
All right, I think we've come to a little bit of an agreement here, but we're going to go into the back of Chick-fil-A one day and decide this argument once and for all.
Bobby, I'm there, dude.
Today we're talking to Ty Ray. We're talking the Sinclair controversy. Now, if you don't know what this is, Sinclair Broadcasting Corporation, which owns hundreds of stations across the United States, decided that they were going to impose a written script on all their TV channels that had to be read, no choice, calling out fake news and members of the media for fabricating stories. Now, the obvious bone to pick that we in the media have to do with that is that this undermines the work that journalists everywhere do. It basically says, you know, we're not part of this, but everyone else who's part of this is doing this, which, you know, undermines everyone. I certainly think there's issues in the media that need to be confronted with, but this conspiracy against the media that gets pushed at every turn sort of infiltrates how we do things. There's necessary adjustments that need to be made, but I think the public outcry is pulling it in the wrong direction, like completely fabricating stuff, intentionally deceiving the public. I don't think those are issues that the mainstream media has to confront with. So I am pulling him in here to get his perspective on this. Our guest today hails from the state of Washington. You know him. Big presence at CLNS Media. Let me give him a little rundown, give him the Bobcast introduction. We love to give all our guests here. He was a former weekend sports director at several local news outlets, worked in the Denver area, the Washington area. He has experience in radio. There's just too many. Normally I name off all the companies people work for. There's just too many to mention here.
Yeah, and now, that's not a good thing, Bobby. That's not necessarily a good thing.
Since 2013, he's hosted the Beats and Eats podcast here on CLNS Media. He's now working in Tacoma, Washington, the home of, as he loves to say, Isaiah Thomas and Avery Bradley. And he's a host here on the Celtics postgame show with myself. He is Ty Ray. And Ty, we're not here under great circumstances. It's going to be a negative show, a very downtrodden view of the media out here, as you know, is widely prevalent out there, but maybe you'll be able to give us a positive spin on it, some hope for the future.
Yeah, I always try to think positive, Bobby, but this Sinclair thing, the Sinclair ownership of stations, it does bother me because I don't want to become Russian TV, and I like to keep the government out of my broadcasting, right? And with Sinclair, I have my doubts, quite frankly. I have my doubts. And this dates back, Bobby, all the way to the 2004 presidential campaign. I don't know if you recall this. You may be too young to recall this, Bobby. Mm-hmm. But during the campaign between Bush and John Kerry, Sinclair stations were mandated to run a hit piece on John Kerry. I don't know if you're aware of that. Go all the way back to 2004. Your listeners can Google that. So this whole thing with Sinclair isn't new.
Yeah.
They've had an agenda that they've wanted to force on their television affiliates since at least 2004. So when this whole Deadspin video came out, thanks to Tim Burke at Deadspin, who put it all together, all these station anchors, reporters reading this script and trying to disguise it as a station promo. Here's a clue, Bobby. It wasn't a station promo. You know why it's not a station or network promo? Because I've never, ever, ever read a station promo, and I've read many of them where I criticize the competition, ever.
Mm-hmm.
It was always about us. And the other thing that really bothered me about this script read by the Sinclair anchor and reporters is that it mentioned fake news. Fake news. Now, who is the person that invented fake news?
Who invented the word fake?
The media is really the word, I think one of the greatest of all terms I've come up with is fake. I guess other people have used it perhaps over the years, but I've never noticed it.
Yeah, who invented that? In fact, as we're talking right now on my Twitter feed in regards to the EPA head, Scott Pruitt, Trump is tweeting about fake news and how fake news is blowing his scandal out of proportion. So fake news came from Donald Trump, and yet magically Sinclair includes this in this script they have their anchors read. So I find this whole thing very dangerous. I'm also scared because, of course, Sinclair is acquiring more and more stations. They're on the verge of acquiring Tribune TV stations. They already own 183 local affiliates. That's 40%. Of U.S. households across the nation, including Como Television here in my market, which is an ABC affiliate. I'm really curious as to see what happens to my local affiliate, Bobby, because my old boss, when I was in Denver, Colorado, at the Fox-owned and operated station, yes, I worked for Fox, mm-hmm. actual Fox. My old boss there, Bill Dahlman, will be taking over at Como. So I'm kind of curious to see what happens to that Sinclair-owned affiliate.
It is concerning. And the one positive in all this, there's been a lot of discussion about the issues with the media, the negative perceptions of the media nowadays. But the fact that light is being shined on this does give you a little bit of hope. That's my first positive spin on it, is the fact that this has been blown up. Everyone's seeing it. It's online. And people are going to be more aware of that when they're viewing the news, when they're seeing Sinclair broadcasts. And even if they see that floating around online, they know, boom, Deadspin exposed this, and they have a better idea. Like, I feel like as crazy as things can be nowadays with some of the misinformation that's out there and the spin that's on things, I do feel good about the fact that journalists, even an organization like Deadspin that I don't think many people would consider like a pristine journalistic organization, they're doing this is like the work that needs to be done in media nowadays. Like, little organizations like this, I know they're owned by a big syndicate themselves, but they're not afraid to go out and uncover this. Like, this wasn't the New York Times doing this. It was Deadspin.
And more than ever, we need brave souls in the media uncovering the nonsense, especially with what's going on with our president. I won't even mention his name. But it's just frightening, Bobby, to know that we've now blurred the line so much that the layman at home who goes to work 9 to 5 can't keep track of everything, right? Because we don't know what's real, what's not real. And you and I, who are news connoisseurs, we can kind of sift through all this, right? We can separate what isn't real, what is real, because we're that savvy. We're a savvy news consumer. But if you're a family of five, you're a mom and dad, both working jobs, you've got three kids, you're taking them to soccer practice, you're taking them to doctor's appointments, going to school meetings, do you have time to really separate that? I'm not so sure.
Yes.
And I'm not faulting them. It's just that there's other things going on in their lives to be this new savvy consumer. So it's real easy for them to get fed stories that may not be true,
mm-hmm.
or to hear from our president when he says things that aren't true and take it as gospel. It very much is frustrating to me. What else is frustrating to me, Bobby, is the fact that Sinclair worked with Jared Kushner, of course, the president's son-in-law, mm-hmm. right? They worked out a deal to get favorable coverage during the campaign. Let me ask you a question, Bobby. Could you imagine in 2012 when President Obama was running against Mitt Romney, if President Obama had worked out a deal with a news organization for favorable coverage?
We know the difference.
By the way, with Michelle Obama's, let's just say, or one of his daughter's boyfriends, you're getting my point here. The Republican establishment would have went bananas, but this whole Jared Kushner Sinclair thing falls under the radar screen.
I don't want to make this too partisan right here, because I think there's bigger news issues at play, and there's a number of different issues at play when it comes around this specific issue. Because my thing has always been with this, negative perception out there with the media, the things that are the whole fake news movement, I would say, is what I would describe as one of the problems at play here. But there are actual issues with the media nowadays that do need to be addressed. And while you have legitimate concerns out there, what you usually hear is just the blasphemous stuff like this, where just these false, wide-ranging accusations are being thrown around about the whole media. And when you really throw everything that's out there in the media under one umbrella, it's a dangerous thing.
So you can't do that.
You've been working in media since the 80s. I do want to get
thanks,
into your...
Bobby. thanks a lot.
I do want to get into your origins. What made you want to be involved in the media, and what was the perception of the media back in the 80s, if you were to compare it now?
Wow. Well, I got into the media because I can't sing or dance.
You can speak, though. I'll give you that. Good speaker.
No, I just was really drawn to it, even as a child. So let me rewind even further back from the 80s. So I was a child in the 70s, and back in the 70s, Bobby, we had CBS, NBC, ABC, and if we were lucky, we had a PBS station in our market, and if you had the money, you got some cable channels. It wasn't like today, where we're just inundated with channels we don't watch. We only had a handful of stations that we could sit down and watch during the evening. And one of the first stories I can recall watching was the Patty Hearst kidnapping. Now, for all of you young guys who are not familiar with the Patty Hearst kidnapping, CNN actually just did a special on this. Go back and read on it. It was just drama night after night. Patty Hearst was the son, the daughter of William Randolph Hearst, gazillionaire. She's kidnapped. She joins a terrorist organization. She's kidnapped. She's brainwashed. She's robbing banks. Every night, this is on the local news. And I think I was like 10 years old, Bobby, and I'm watching this unfold before my very eyes, night after night after night after night. It was just a huge soap opera. They were playing the tapes of her kidnapping, where she would do these speeches on tape. It was just incredible watching this whole soap opera unfold. So I got glued to that. And then in the 80s, I really became absorbed with the news during the Iranian hostage crisis. And that, we forget, was such a big deal in this country, probably responsible, Bobby, actually, for Ronald Reagan getting to become the president of the United States, because Carter was under siege during that entire time when the hostages were taken. For those of you not familiar with this, 1970, 1980, the Iranian hostages are taken in Tehran. The embassy, the U.S. embassy, is seized. The crisis goes on for more than a year.
Great movie about that, Argo. Too.
Argo, tremendous film, tremendous film. There was actually a rescue mission that failed in the desert right outside of Iran. Just a gripping story. I kept a notebook on this for my class, like daily. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the Iranian hostage crisis was the birth of Nightline, ABC Nightline. Remember ABC Nightline? Mm-hmm. They still have it, but it's not like it was. ABC Nightline now is more of it goes up again. Well, no, they don't have it now, do they? Because Kimmel's on. What am I talking about? I go to bed at 9:00, Bobby. I don't watch late night TV. But so that was the birth of that show, because they would do updates on the Iranian hostage crisis and the negotiations and the drama that was unfolding. So those two events really got me excited about television news. And then I really got interested in politics about 1984. And I've loved following campaigns. I love the drama of that. Although I will say this, now that I'm older, I'm so jaded, and the conventions aren't what they used to be. And I used to watch conventions gavel to gavel, man. I used to be so excited about watching them on the news. So I went to Washington State University, went to Edward R. Murrow School of Broadcast. Edward R. Murrow, arguably the best journalist of our time. And I just found a love of news, and I wanted to be a sports anchor. And I did that for, boy, about 20 years of my life. And here I am, retired, glad the industry changed. Very little pay, Bobby, horrible hours. And now you can get your sports news on the internet, on your phone. You don't need to stay up till 11 o'clock to watch me yammer on about the Red Sox game. You can watch it in real time on your phone. You can watch it unfold. So, but back then it was really cool to anchor an 11 o'clock news sportscast because you knew people were waiting to see you, and you were delivering the news about their favorite teams or their local college or high school. And sometimes it was fun because you would feel their wrath if their team lost. They would actually call you on the phone just to vent, kind of like we do on call-in shows or podcasts.
And I bet you have loved that transition to podcasting. It's a lot being in broadcasting. I don't think the general consumer realizes when they see someone on the camera all the stuff that goes into not only getting into that field, but working in it day to day. Like you said, even back then, I guess, and today, the pay is not amazing. And you even see the students now. I mean, Syracuse, very broadcasting focused. And the students that are in that program, they do a lot. The classes are long. The assignments are tremendously expansive.
So, and cameras have gotten smaller. Okay, so back in the day when I was covering, let's say, high school football back in the 90s, I had a 3/4-inch deck on my back with a camera and a tripod. And I had to get the footage, get back to the station, edit it together. Then I had to get my makeup on, comb my hair, write my script. There were some things that were just downright. I could tell you stories, Bobby. I won't waste your time. We'll talk about it off air sometimes. But just some of the crazy stuff that went on, just trying to get shows on air. Everything from blackouts to doing sports by candlelight to doing live shots with high beams from cars. Because my light kit went down at a sporting event. Just the absolute zaniness and craziness, dogs running on set. Just just funny though. Yeah. Funny stuff that you probably wouldn't see today that had some charm to it. But you're absolutely right, Bobby. People are not making the money they used to. There are people that I feel aren't qualified to work in the market sizes they do now. That's not necessarily a criticism of them. That's just the environment, the way it is. When I was younger, I likened myself to, say, a minor league baseball player, right? You'd start in a small market, work in a medium-sized market, and then you get to the big leagues. So you could hone your skills. And now, because wages are so low, stations don't mind hiring kids because they'll take those wages. So you see younger people working in larger markets, which wasn't the case years ago.
Best part about working in local news? What was the worst memory working there? And what was the greatest lesson you took from your career as a broadcaster?
Wow. Let me think about this, Bobby. Those are loaded questions. Just some great things that come to my mind. So when I was working in Denver, I started there in 2000. Brand new station. It was Fox owned. Spare no expense. We were actually covering the All-Star game, right? So the All-Star game was on Fox. This was 2001, I believe. 2001, All-Star game on Fox. We're blowing it out. We're flying Ty out to Seattle. How cool is that for me, right? Mm-hmm. My home area. I'm getting flown out to Seattle to cover the All-Star game. The Mariners that year won 116 games. It was Ichiro's first year in Seattle. So he's like Elvis. It was just absolutely insane. So there I am in my home area covering this incredible event, watching the Mariners play. And, you know, they've always been the dog in the market, right? The Seahawks and Sonics were the love of the era. The Mariners were always a distant third. Anyway, I get to go cover this huge event in my hometown with Ichiro, doing all these stories, going live back to Denver. I'm at the All-Star game. Cal Ripken Jr. hits a home run in his last All-Star game. You know, Tommy Lasorda's there. All the guys are there. It was just an incredible – it was a feeling, honestly, that I had arrived. Does that make sense? Covering an event like that, I felt like I had arrived. Now, from there, I would go on to cover other things like NFL playoffs, and I covered the Colorado Avalanche when they won the Stanley Cup, and that was really cool. Ray Bourque, for you Boston fans, was on that team, and that was really neat seeing him win a Stanley Cup for the first time, because he had never won one, even with all those great teams in Boston. So that was a real big thrill. But prior to that, I'm just trying to think of really cool things at the top of my head that were huge thrills for me. 1992, George Bush running against Bill Clinton. I'm working in Medford, Oregon, which is a very small city in Oregon. It's a very tiny market. And George Bush, the father George Bush, was campaigning in Medford because it was a very conservative town. Bill Clinton was actually up Interstate 5 in Portland. And me and a friend of mine, another reporter, were like, well, we're covering George Bush down here in Medford. Why don't we grab our camera, drive up Interstate 5, and see if we can get words with Bill Clinton, right? And so people are looking at us in the newsroom like, yeah, he's just going to drop everything and talk to you guys. Sure. Right? Yeah, CNN is up there. All the national media is there. He's just going to talk to you podunk guys from KTVL in Medford, Oregon. So me and my friend Nick Barris, who's still a reporter in Nashville, we pile in a car. We get, you know, we put our suits on. We drive up Interstate 5, which is about, you know, 4 hours from Medford, get to Portland, make it through the mob. And Bill Clinton, savvy enough at that time to realize we were from a different region of Oregon. Now, back then, remember, we don't have all the TV channels. So candidates had to be savvy about who they spoke to so they could make sure the word got out in particular areas. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like today. So Bill Clinton makes his way over to us to talk to us. Still one of the biggest thrills in my life, because here I'm this young kid and candidate Clinton is coming over to talk to us, and I'm running the camera and I'm trying to make sure I'm as steady as I possibly can, and Nick's a nervous wreck getting the soundbite from candidate Clinton. We got it. We were so ecstatic. We run back to the affiliate in Portland and beam it down to our station in Medford via microwave. Microwave, can you believe that? Anyway, our newsroom couldn't believe it. Our newsroom could not believe it. There are so many like that, Bobby, and they're not readily available at the top of my mind right now, but I've covered so many wonderful events and met so many, you know, I remember meeting Jesse Jackson and having a half-hour conversation with him about his son, who at the time was playing football. And I just saw him on TV the other day because he was talking about the 50-year unfortunate anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King. And of course, Jesse Jackson was there that night, but he and I talked about football, and that was the cool thing. So here I'm talking to Jesse Jackson about football. We're not talking about politics, and it's just two guys talking. I mean, it was just the coolest feeling. So that was one of my highlights. But just, I've met so many people. It's been a privilege. I haven't really reminisced like this in a long time, Bobby. I'll tell you what.
This show, that's what it's all about.
So I don't regret it. I don't know what I would have done, honestly, Bobby, had I not been on TV and radio. I have no idea what I would have done.
And a lot of people do go into these fields chasing sports. That's the fun. I mean, that we love them growing up. We want to be around them into our adulthood. But like you said right there, when you get into media, you do get an appreciation for, you know, the real news, the real stories. And on
Thank you. That
stands out to me, too, because I was just in a similar place coming into media. You know, I always wanted to do sports. But then when you get around, you know, real stories, you do get fascinated by them.
Always. Yeah. Always. And here's one bit of advice I have for anybody doing sports. Now, I kind of had a chip on my shoulder back in the day. I chose sports because I loved sports. Mm-hmm. But I considered myself a reporter first and foremost, meaning I could go out and cover anything because the same principles apply.
Yep.
And what I really objected to over my years in a newsroom was people looking at me as the sports guy. I hated being called that. I absolutely
they didn't even want you to come in on that day.
Right. I hate it being called that because it's like they didn't see my value more than reading whether or not the Red Sox beat the A's. They didn't see my value any more than that. And so I spent an entire career trying to show people that I was worthy of covering any story that they could cover. That was my goal. So that meant, like, in 1992, when we went down and talked to President Clinton, well, guess what? That election, we were all young kids back then, and not everybody could was good at doing live shots, et cetera, and I was pretty good on my feet. I did our election coverage, which was really cool. They put me on, our sports guy, doing election coverage. And they're like, well, why does he get to do election coverage? Because there are winners and losers, and campaigns have momentum. A lot of sports, a lot of sports comparisons there. Mm-hmm. So I've done a lot of news stories, and actually my career ended with me anchoring morning news at a Seattle radio station for 2 years. I just didn't want to do it anymore. I was tired. I got tired of getting up early in the morning, Bobby, and I got tired. It actually happened during the campaign too. And I just got tired of hearing about Hillary, and I got tired of hearing about Donald. You know, you get the idea. I just had enough. It was not feeding my soul. All the stories were negative. We very seldom focused on the positive, and after a while that takes a toll on a person. But I have no regrets about having done TV news and radio, and I saw the evolution, which was kind of fun too.
Yeah, that was my last question. You've said it to me several times that TV news has changed over the years. What has changed about it in particular?
Well, like I said earlier in the podcast, Bobby, is that people would stay up to watch me when I was doing sports. They had no other way of getting access to the scores. You couldn't go online. Where were you going to get it from? Mm-hmm. Where were you going to get that information from? So I was must-see TV. Now, local affiliate television, they're not, because you can get those stories throughout the day on Twitter. I'm just as guilty. I follow my I'm a Twitter addict. I'm constantly following my Twitter feed. Constantly. And if anybody follows me on Twitter, they know I'm constantly commenting, which probably would drive people crazy. I'm either commenting on the Celtics or Donald Trump. Take your pick.
Yeah, and that's the place where it is going to come out first. If you're watching SportsCenter and following along on Twitter at the same exact time, you're going to get the story on Twitter first. Then you're probably going to wait 10, 15 minutes until it's dropping on TV.
Yeah, exactly. You're exactly right. And I used to love SportsCenter. Awesome. Being in the 80s, I used to love SportsCenter, and I used to love when it was Patrick and Oberman, and I've really grew to not like it, because I can't take, once again, the blurred lines, right? On even SportsCenter, when you get your highlights, but then you get way too much commentary.
But we are concerned about troubling and irresponsible one-sided news stories plaguing our country.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and false
news has become all too common on social media.
More alarming, some media outlets Unfortunately, some members of the media use their platforms to push their own personal bias and agenda to control exactly what people think, and this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
That's something that frustrates me about this whole fake news movement, is that people think the journalists are behind it and the news people are behind it.
Right! It's so ridiculous, Bobby.
If you go to a journalist school and just, like, sit down in a classroom, like, every single other minute, it's emphasized how important it is to tell the truth and
have
standards for yourself. And, like, that is emphasized left and right in newsrooms and organizations. And, you know, the news people aren't even close to being behind this. It's
not even close. So this is what has infuriated me about my friends on the right. And I don't want to turn this into I just don't. But the idea that somehow all these reporters and executive producers and news directors were all sitting in this smoky-filled room smoking cigarettes, right, figuring out a way to screw over the right is ridiculous. People are hardworking, blue-collar. It is, to me, a blue-collar profession. They're working hard, long hours to get the story right. And to see people crapped on like that, that really upsets me, Bobby. It really does. And I take great offense to it, and especially from people who have no clue how a newsroom or a news organization works. For them to comment on how a newsroom, it's just ignorant. It's not how it works. And the wall there between the newsroom and the corporation that owns this newsroom, that newsroom, is an important one. And for Sinclair to do what they did is, to me, unforgivable, absolutely unforgivable. And I'm hoping that what we talked about in the beginning, and you brought this up, that Deadspin shined a light on this, and we're all talking. In fact, I went to an event last night where I was talking to a PR group who was talking about this whole thing. So maybe this gets the discussion going, and Sinclair will back off. That's my hope anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a general feeling of anger, distrust, frustration with the media nowadays. And like I said at the beginning, I think some of those concerns can be founded. Like, there are a lot of issues with the media nowadays. I know you're an old school guy, so you must be frustrated with some of the things you see in how news coverage has changed. You talked about ESPN too, that the commentary influxation has been massive. And in TV news in general, that seems to be the movement. We talked to a Pulitzer Prize winning here at school the other day. His name was Jim Asher, another old school guy. And he just said the biggest change he's seen in journalism over his years is that, you know, there's not a bad job being done particularly, but there is a polarization and a politicization in almost everything that goes on out there. And that seems to be where people's frustration comes from, and that's legitimate. You know, there are people who do want to see their news without a political lens, but it gets filtered through this lens that the news is inherently trying to deceive people in the fake news movement, and then it just gets so ruptured by this conspiracy that the criticisms kind of become unfounded. You have legit criticism, and then you just have conspiracy. And I think the conspiracy kind of ruins the fact that the news does have to make real adjustments and do a better job, because you find yourself defending yourself against unjust criticism while at the same time having to come to grips with some of the things that you're doing wrong. Those two things really complicate the issues going hand in hand with each other, I think.
They do. They do. I just will end by saying this, Bobby. Every journalist I have ever met in my life wants to get the story right. Mm-hmm. We don't need to make this any more complicated than it is. Most journalists are professional. Some on a daily basis risk their lives to get the story right.
Yeah.
Risk their lives. And that needs to be respected. And journalists need to be respected. And there's nothing I think more important in this country, Bobby, than a free press. So to see what's going on with Sinclair is frightening. However, to see the reaction to Sinclair, I would be more scared if there was apathy. But Sinclair was met head on.
Yep.
And that does my heart good.
Do you think
that does my heart good?
Do you think there's hope that the general public could begin to trust the media more than they do now again?
I don't think so, Bobby. I really don't. And once again, it goes back to, I think we're so busy with our lives. You and I, like we were talking about earlier, we're invested in the news. We're savvy news connoisseurs. I think people are so busy. They're getting their news from so many different sources that they can't, you know, sources that they can't figure out if they're telling the truth or not. People getting news from Facebook, and we don't need to go there. That's a completely different podcast. But getting news from sources you can't verify, and nor do you have time to do that. So we're just inundated by so many sources. Think about how many sources we have on Twitter alone, right? I consider that news feed important to me. But sometimes we get retweets from sources. We don't know who they are. We have no way of verifying them. So I don't know. I don't know if they'll ever trust again. All I know is I do long for the days when Walter Cronkite was the most trusted man in America. Well, I, honestly, Bobby, I miss the day when our politicians were trusted too. And I think it all goes hand in hand.
Ty Ray is on Twitter at Coug88. You can follow him there. Always ragging against the new school. We could do a whole nother podcast on old school versus new school. I'd love to have that conversation with you too. But
oh, that would be fun.
Had to have you here to talk media because, as you said, we're both connoisseurs here, but you have a little more experience and insight from the past than I do. So I appreciate you being aboard
yeah.
and giving that to us here today.
No, thanks, Bobby. It's a real pleasure talking to you. And it also gives me an opportunity to look back on all the things that I've been able to do over the years. And sometimes I don't just sit back and think about it. And it's been a real pleasure.
That's Bobcast 37. Thanks to Ty Ray, Anthony Vasquez, Leo Christopoulopoulos. By the way, I need $1,000 more before the end of April. So if you are feeling generous, help me out. I'm trying to raise $7,500 for Beth Israel's Cancer Center. You can find that link over on my Twitter page. And on Monday, we are running the Boston Marathon. Looking like rain right now, but hopefully that'll change. So if you're in Boston area, I want to see you out there. I'm going to need you out there. And the rest of this week, we have some great guests. Danny McDonald of the Boston Globe is with us tomorrow on Wednesday. And Thursday, we talk to another Dan Fitzgerald, who got me through this training to be able to run the Boston Marathon. So we're going to hear some tips, some memories, some stories he has from running the marathon and other things over the years. I'm Bobby Manning. Subscribe to the Bobcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and download the CLNS Media app. See you tomorrow.